people become heroes by putting one foot in front of the other. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to save humanity today. They wake up and they say, I'm going to keep breathing long enough to get breakfast on the table for my toddler. And then I'm going to go to work. And then I'm going to do the next right thing.
We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
Welcome to the Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, I'm Amanda Weinstein, and you're listening to the Suburban Women Problem. We'll be back next week with a new season of regular episodes, but before that, we wanted to share a conversation between Red, Wine, and Blue founder Katie Paris and our favorite historian, Heather Cox Richardson. Last month, the City Club of Cleveland here in Ohio hosted an event with Heather and Katie. Heather's words were a warning about how we're on the knife edge of authoritarianism. But as usual, her words were also full of hope about what regular people like us can do to keep our democracy. I love to hear conversations, any conversation with Heather Cox Richardson. She has a way of grounding what's going on now with real events of history and what people were doing, not just our presidents. And I love the pairing of Heather Cox Richardson with Katie to talk about what we can do to move our democracy forward, to protect our democracy, and to protect this nation. So enjoy this live conversation from the City Club, and we'll see you again next week for the premiere of the new season of The Suburban Women Problem.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the City Club of Cleveland, where we are devoted to conversations of consequence that help democracy thrive. Our guest today, Heather Cox Richardson, reminds us that the past doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes. In 2019, Richardson began publishing Letters from an American on Substack, which offered historical context in the face of an unrelenting news cycle. Soon, her posts were reaching 1 million subscribers, making her one of the most successful authors on the platform. Moderating the conversation today is Katie Paris, founder of Red, Wine, and Blue. Members and friends of the City Club of Cleveland, please join me in welcoming Katie Paris and Heather Cox Richardson.
Well, thank you, everyone. And of course, Heather, welcome to Cleveland. We're so thrilled to have you.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
You know, at Red, Wine, and Blue, you know, the wine is a metaphor. Anything you want to have in that wine glass is just fine with us. And so today, in honor of Heather, she always has Diet Pepsi in her wine glass.
Diet Pepsi in my wine glass. And unfortunately, I didn't ever notice how much it looks like red wine until I was having a conversation with somebody at like 10:30 in the morning, and he was really distracted. And finally he goes, I'm so sorry, but I just have to ask, are you drinking? And I was like, no, it's Diet Pepsi. But yeah, so the cheers. It's
cheers.
Lovely to be here.
Cheers to you in Cleveland.
And to you all. And to Cleveland.
Okay, so this is a well-timed conversation. I think it's fair to say we're in a critical moment of tension in terms of what we're going into between now and November. In your book, in your newsletters, for those of us who read them day in and day out, for those of us who consumed your book very quickly, we know what you mean when you say that here we stand in America on the knife edge of authoritarianism. Okay, for people in this room, you all nod, but for a lot of people outside this room, that sounds unbelievable. That sounds like hyperbole. So what can you do to help equip us and think about what is the most straightforward way that we can go out and talk about this? Maybe key pieces of evidence that you see based on your historical context that leads you to confidently say, this isn't just a sense of things. It's not just maybe a threat. This is real.
So it's a really good question, because one of the things that I think people don't recognize is that the things that the former President Trump and the people around him talk about are so extreme that if you talk to somebody who has not been clued in, they're like, oh yeah, right. Yeah, like really somebody's gonna go ahead and round up 10 million people and put them in camps and deport them? Come on, you're like fantasizing about that. Or really, come on, they're not gonna go after Social Security and Medicare. You know, that's not going to happen. Oh, of course they're not going to criminalize certain kinds of contraception. You know, and I could go on and on and on. And that's actually a technique of authoritarians. And it was one that was that was articulated very well in Germany in the rise of Hitler, that if you make a lie big enough that most people can't imagine saying something so outrageous, you can slide it under the door, in a sense. That is, I always tell my students, you know, if your roommate steals 20 bucks from you, you're going to be mad at them, because you can imagine that. But if your roommate hacks into your computers, sells your parents' house, wipes out their, you know, all their income, destroys their jobs, and completely decimates your family, you can't believe anybody would do that. So you might not get nearly as mad at all. And that's kind of what we're looking at now, I think. I do want to emphasize once again, we are on a knife edge. It is not new. It's been coming for a long time. But this is the election that will guarantee that there will be another election in 2028. If we do not do it right this time, the future does not look good. So the question is, how do you convince people who aren't paying attention to pay attention? And one of the things I do, as you know, I look backward in time. And this looks to me very much like two previous periods in our history, maybe three if you'll give me that much time. One is the 1850s, which looked very much like the present in that, you know, the elite Southern enslavers took over the Democratic Party and piece by piece took over the federal government. They took over the Supreme Court. They took over the Senate. They took over the White House. And people who didn't want the institution of enslavement to spread across the country didn't pay a lot of attention because, you know, there was the Industrial Revolution really taking off in the North, and there were new canals, and there were new railroads, and there was new farmland, and there was, you know, cities growing and towns dying and other things going on, so people really weren't paying attention. You know, they were also going to church. They were doing all kinds of other things in that period. And then all of a sudden in 1854, the elite Southern enslavers pushed through the House of Representatives the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act allowed human enslavement to move into the American West. And that meant that those Western territories would become slaveholding states, and those slaveholding states would work together with the Southern slaveholding states to make enslavement national and turn the country into a national system of enslavement that was overseen by the small group of elite Southern enslavers. And when that happened, people woke up. And they looked at each other and they said, listen, we don't agree about transportation, and we don't agree about immigration, we don't agree about finances. There's all kinds of things we don't agree about, but we can agree that that is not democracy. That turning this country over to a few rich people to run our lives as they see fit, treating us all as lesser human beings, is not democracy. And they began to work together, first as anti-Kansas people, anti-Nebraska people, and quickly they began to work together as a new political party. And what they did, and one of the reasons I keep using Lincoln as a touchstone, is they went back to foundational principles. What does it mean to live in a democracy? Not what's happening right now in the Ohio legislature, or what's happening in Texas, and oh no, what's happening over there and wherever, and all the stuff that's bombarding us all the time. They went back to, listen, this is what we believe in. We believe that people should be treated equally before the law. They should have a right to a say in their government, and the rich guys don't get to get everything. And that's really what they started with. And so when I think about this moment, a lot of what I do is I cut through the stuff that's coming at you all the time. And if you are overwhelmed, you should be, because you look at all the different pieces moving as I do every day. And sometimes I sit down at the computer and I think, where do I even start today? Like, because this is a really important speech. Oh, wait, look what they did in the House of Representatives. Oh, crap, Texas is at it again. Oh, no, don't even start with me on Ukraine. And I'm doing it really because I love it. And for me, putting it into order really helps ground me. So I want to do it. If you don't want to do it, it is completely overwhelming. I understand why there are some days people write to me and they say, I can't even deal with it today. But if you walk away from that and you step back and say, a lot of this is noise, what I care about are these principles. The principles of protecting our institutions, including, for example, higher education, including institutions like this. I care about being treated equally before the law, which means everybody needs to be treated equally before the law. I care about everybody paying their fair share and what that might look like, and figure out what matters to you. And what you're going to figure out pretty quickly is that there right now in the United States is a Democratic group of people, regardless of what letters are after their names. And there is an anti-democratic group of people. And the letters after their names right now are R's or M-A-G-A. And those people need to be replaced in our government or we will lose democracy.
So while at the same time recognizing that we are on this knife edge, at the same time, I've heard you say over and over again that we are actually, you believe, reclaiming it. We are reclaiming our country, our democracy faster than people think. I think many of us in this room maybe can relate to that if we think about it just from our experiences last year passing issue one in Ohio, right? A citizen-led...
By a lot.
That's right. By a lot, Democrats, independents, Republican voters coming together, supporting that, which was a far cry from where our representatives were in terms of passing a six-week abortion ban. And so that was an example, both in August and in November, of the majority being heard. And I think that, for me, feels like an example of, okay, we can do this, we can reclaim our country. But sometimes it can be hard to sort of feel that and to grasp onto those things. We're going to try to do it again with gerrymandering this year. But what are other examples, and maybe more at a national level too, that convince you that we are actually reclaiming our country?
All right. So first of all, stop reading the damn polls, okay? I get laughing about them. And of course, there are some polls actually need to pay attention to, and there are some very good pollsters out there. But I laugh. After every election, there's all these articles going, boy, the polls were wrong. I'm like, have you noticed a pattern here? And one of the things that we've seen since the decision, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, is that Democratic candidates are overperforming by 6 to 8 points in so far every election that involves reproductive rights. And why that continues to be a surprise, I just can't imagine. But what we're really looking at, as I say, in this moment that looks to me so much like the past, is minority rule, which is one of the reasons I think that we are reacting the way we are to so many of the decisions that are being handed down. You know, the idea that rather than actually having our Congress, or in some cases our legislatures, do things, we're relying instead on judicial decisions, which is what we've seen just, I don't know what day it is, but with the last thing the Supreme Court did, the idea that basically what people like Mitch McConnell, who's a Republican from senator from Kentucky, have done is they have shut down our representative system and replaced it with the decisions put in place by extremist judges that, again, the Senate has put into place. What we're seeing around us, I think, is minority rule, where a very small group of people is managing to stop the processes of our democracy and put in place their own, what used to be an oligarchical system, but now is Christian nationalism, and it does not represent us. So in terms of where do I see this, more than 80% of Americans, you can do the math there, that's not one party or the other, more than 80% of Americans want common sense gun safety legislation. 69% of Americans in the most recent survey want to see the protections of Roe versus Wade codified into law. 69%. That's the most recent one. You know, I could go on down this list. We agree on most issues in general across this country. And those are not the positions that are being put into place in our legislatures and in our national government. And that's the piece that I look at. And I look at groups like this, and I look at the sheer numbers of people who are turning out across the country to defend democracy. That's not necessarily to defend one party or another, but to defend democracy. And I don't think that shows up, certainly in the national polls, but it also doesn't show up in the national media, which tends to be centered in cities, especially in eastern cities, and has itself its own model of capitalization, which has made it much more vulnerable to specific views of what the country looks like, as opposed to people like me who have come from outside and are looking at a very different set of people and a very different set of participation people who are participating in the system.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about the momentum and this feeling of we have to take our country back too, I mean, you all just in this room, this event, an event with an author who writes day in and day out about democracy was sold out over a month ago.
About history. You
know, just about history.
Can I say about history? And I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but that does... I've been traveling around the country now for months, and the rooms are all full of people who care about the country, because you know what? This is a really cool country. And one of the things that we have not done enough, I think, is to celebrate our victories in the expansion of democracy because we thought that they would always be here. And now that we recognize that while we were thinking that the protections of the liberal consensus that we put in place after World War II would always be here, people have been eroding that. And now is the moment when we simply must protect it or lose it. And the reality is that the vast majority of us want to protect it. And this is our moment.
You have talked a lot about sort of the catalyst of Dobbs, of Roe v. Wade. Now we see our rights being further eroded. You know, the Alabama ruling, IVF, birth control, there's, you know, the ramifications are huge on this. It makes me think how going into 2022, we would say on all those calls, ignore the pundits, ignore the polls. You know what you know, and you know what the people around you care about too. And I wonder if there isn't something actually to being underestimated, because I feel it happening all over again, Heather. You know, with these questions, I mean, do you hear it too? You know, oh, well, we'll see. You know, that happened back in 2022, that whole Dobbs decision. You know, are women, are Americans going to still care about this all the way into 2024? And it makes me think, sometimes it pisses me off. I'm like, why are they so out of touch? Why are they not understanding this? But then I wonder, Heather, is there not something to be being underestimated? The element of surprise, and is there a strategic advantage there that we might learn from history?
So I was at a meeting with mostly women at an event recently, and a young man said to one of the people there, you know, I understand that Dobbs was important and abortion was important in 2022, but how are you going to keep that salient? And every woman at the place turned to him and went, and in terms of, I actually do think being underestimated is a good thing, not least because especially older white women are not the people who are being kept from voting. So this is an important, I mean, to not, you know, again, this is a group of people who tend to be overlooked. Invisible can be good at times, I think. But the other piece of this moment that always strikes me, and I'm thinking a lot about this lately, is one of the things that has created the populist group that is working now to overturn our democracy was a quite deliberate effort on the part of the Nixon administration to convince that group that the elites looked down on them. And, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think about how what I do and what people like me do is actually trust the people. And, you know, at the end of the day, when I get discouraged and people say to me, like, look at what's going on. How can you have any faith? I look at our history and the fact that at the end of the day, you know, Winston Churchill said the Americans finally do the right thing after they've tried everything else. But the reality is at the end of the day, when they are asked to do the right thing, the American people do the right thing. They protect democracy. Look at the fact that over the course of our history, when the founders wrote the Declaration of Independence, which declared we had the right to be treated equally before the law and a right to a say in their government, they not only believed that indigenous Americans were savages, their word, and they certainly had no use for women as anything in the body politic, and they literally owned other human beings. We have gone from that to the world we live in today. And the way that we did that was by convincing those people who did have the power of the vote to expand it. And they expanded it never because they thought, I'll be nice to those people. They expanded it always because they recognized that if they lost, if they deprived another group of people of the right to equality before the law or the right to a say in their government, it was only a question of time until they would lose it themselves. And when you think about it that way, and you think about the expansion of democracy we have enjoyed in the last 250 years, I have faith that the American people will do it again. And that seems to me to be the exact opposite of the idea that the elites look down on people.
When you have often said, Heather, that the real heroes of democracy are just everyday people. And I think sometimes it can feel hard to connect like what's going on in our local community, even in our state or our neighborhood, to this project of saving democracy. What does local activism, the things that any of us can be involved in here, have to do with saving democracy?
There is this great book that I just loved called Angels of the Underground by Teresa Kaminsky. It's an academic book, really well written, a really good read. And it's about these four women who were the underground resistance in the Philippines during World War II. And I loved it because they're the angels of the underground. They're the heroes, right? And they're so totally normal people. And my favorite of all the women was the woman who, when the Japanese came in and rounded people up and said, you need to show up and you need to be registered and then you can go home again. And of course, what people didn't realize is they were going to be marched away after that. She went with everybody else to be registered. Like all her neighbors went and they were just going to register and then they were going to go home, right? And she goes like everybody else and she has a panic attack. And she can't stay in the room because she's having a panic attack. So she goes home and all her friends are like, no, you got to stay. Just get your name down. You got to stay. And she's like, no, I can't. I got to go home. So she goes home. Everybody else gets rounded up. She's in her apartment by herself for weeks with nobody around her. So what does she do? She looks out the window and she learns what all the Japanese soldiers are doing. All that knowledge that she got because she had a freaking panic attack turns her into one of the angels of the underground. And that, I think, is so much better a model than the idea that somehow Rosa Parks came to us from the goddesses, that people become heroes by putting one foot in front of the other. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to save humanity today. They wake up and they say, I'm going to keep breathing long enough to get breakfast on the table for my toddler. And then I'm going to go to work. And then I'm going to do the next right thing. And that translates for me at a very local level to your everyday life. Speaking up, talking about principles, saying that we can do this, backing the right candidates, not only for president, but for the House of Representatives, even if you are I'm in Ohio, so you guys know that this matters, but even in a deep blue state or a deep red state, you can affect your state Senate, your state House, you can affect your House of Representatives, you can affect your Senate, your senators. But at the local level, you know, your school board matters, your local government matters, even your freaking dog catcher matters. And for me, as a scholar of politics and of ideas, I think the way you change society is by changing ideas. And the way you change ideas is by taking up oxygen every day. And if you think about the coverage that things get in the media, speaking up to newspapers and saying, wait a minute, we don't really like the way that you framed that, or going on Facebook or wherever you are and saying, wait a minute, are you aware of what's happening here? That's how you get involved every single day, even if you don't personally want to run for the Senate.
Something that I love so much about what you do, Heather, is that it does leave people, and I hope people leave here today feeling like, I gotta do something. I don't know what, but I gotta do something. I was already talking to some of the women who are here who said other women they know had already seen you speak while in Cleveland, and they're saying, I saw Heather Cox Richardson speak. I'm joining your group. I'm getting involved. Every single voice matters. So let's have that be, you know, the call.
But look at all of you people here and look at you. We started what we did with nothing. I mean, I started writing on
Facebook. I've never advertised. I won't take advertising. Everything I have done has been because of you people, spreading the message, spreading the word, telling people what's really happening. And it didn't take money. All it took was, you know, am I allowed to say this probably? All it took was putting my ass in the chair, you know? And anybody can do that.
I'm gonna ask one more question, but then I'm going to be turning it over to all of you beautiful people. So be thinking of your questions, mustering that courage to go to the mic, because you're up next. Something I was struck by in your book was you talk a lot about Abraham Lincoln. And you said, you talk about how Lincoln said, you know, democracy will always be challenged by those who seek power. You talk about how the history of democracy is unending. What is the prevention strategy for ever getting this close to losing our democracy again?
I think not forgetting how important it is to protect democracy. You know, we, like I say, I think we are where we are in part because so many of us thought that this was a done deal. And I don't mean just at the local level or the state level or even the national level. I think the reason that democracy is on the ropes across the globe is because we really believed that we had come up with a system that would protect all nations from the kinds of world wars that we saw in the early 20th century, and we didn't protect those institutions. So I think part of it is recognizing how important this is, and that's a way longer discussion that we could go on forever about. But one of the points that I would like to make is that this is a really scary time for sure. The 1850s were scary. The 1890s were scary. The 1930s were scary. 1940s were scary. But out of those things, we always got in this moment, I like to think of it as like the cards being thrown up in the air, or if you guys know the whole butterfly soup thing, which isn't real. Butterflies don't really do that. That's the idea that there's a caterpillar, and in between the caterpillar and the butterfly, it has to turn into soup. We're in the butterfly soup minute. Or the minute where all the cards are up in the air. But the trick is that these are also times of extraordinary creativity. And if you think about it, think of the music we have now and the technology and the new kinds of literature and the new voices and the new foods and the new ways to think about participation in government and the new kinds of architecture. All of those things are happening at the same time the scary stuff is happening as well. And so if you think about this moment and where we are, there's certainly the dark side of that knife edge, but there's also the other side. We get to build that other side. And, you know, if I have one huge regret, it's that I'm hoping to preserve that other side, but because of the age I'm at, I'm really preserving it for the next generation to get to build it. And while that's a wonderful position to be in, think of how exciting it would be to be able to rebuild all of those things. And I sort of think of my role right now is to guarantee that we've got that period of rebuilding and that we at least get to see some of it. So don't lose the joy of democracy as well. It's not just, oh my God, we got to preserve us because it's all we've got. It's, this is what we as human beings get to do. We get to decide the world in which we live, compared to somebody like somebody living in Putin's Russia right now. That's an incredible gift, and it's incredible joy, and it creates spaces like this. So don't let the joy fall away from the fear.
We are about to begin the audience Q&A.
We'll begin with a text question that we received. The DNC and RNC have so much control these days. Can you talk about the role that the current structure and power of the two political parties is in impacting democracy?
So this is an interesting question right now because the RNC is falling apart, which it has become a Trump organization. And one of the things that I have been watching, people for years have been saying to me questions like that, and also, is the Republican Party dying? And I'm always like, because I wrote a history of the Republican Party, I'm always like, no, because the RNC has the lists of everybody on it, and it's got all the money. And it's got institutions where people are like, well, I might not like this person, but there's an R by my name, so I'm going to vote for the R. And we're in a moment right now when I'm not sure that's the case, because when he was in office, former President Trump stacked the state parties with loyalists. And when they did so, they were not necessarily good with money. Look, for example, at Florida right now, where they need to take a loan for the existence of the RNC to keep on going. But also, the different state parties are splitting, as in Arizona and Michigan. And all that to say that the control of the country by the RNC, it seems to me that if there will be a new party rising, now is the moment. And I do think there will be a new party rising on the Republican side or on the right side. In that the ideology behind the traditional Republican Party is very deeply baked into our DNA, and it will return in some fashion. Whether it's got the word Republican or not, I don't know. People are talking about being a constitutional party, a conservative party, all sorts of things. Anyway, on the Democratic side, one of the things to remember, and more generally, is that while we have not in our history had multiple parties, the parties have been big tent parties. And the structural reason we got that was because in our kind of bizarre system, in order to elect people, you have to believe that they can handle every piece of running the government. So in a system where you've got a lot of parties, you might have somebody who's really good at handling the environment and somebody at transportation and somebody at finance, and you can bring them together into a coalition. In our system, one party has to have all those pieces. And it's hard for a new party to have all those pieces. So you might really trust somebody on the environment, but think, oh man, I really don't think you're going to be able to handle international finance, right? So we've got that structural system, but traditionally what we have done is we've brought into those big parties all sorts of different voices. And that's why you have planks in a party platform. And that's why, for example, in 2020, people like Pete Buttigieg stayed in as long as he did, or Amy Klobuchar, or Elizabeth Warren, because they got portfolios within the, I don't call them portfolios, but they got jobs in the new administration, and they got attention paid to their issues. So in terms of the way the separate parties work, I think one is breaking down. I think the other one is really acting pretty much like a traditional party does. Whether that will continue going forward, I'm not sure, but this year is not the year to mess with that. Although there are plenty of ways in which people have been challenging it, including through ranked choice voting, which has worked very well in my home state of Maine.
Day-to-day drama in Congress, especially, where I pay some special attention, is so intense that structural issues tend to recede into the background. We desperately need a better way to appoint Supreme Court justices. And there is a beautiful plan that has now pretty good credibility, dating back about 20 years. And that is to have each president have an appointment in the first 2 years, and then in the second 2 years, and each appointment is for 18 years. You can have the transition to it gradually, don't have to throw anybody out, but it's a staggered appointment, limited term system. It would work beautifully to make the Supreme Court a more evenly responsive institution. How do you feel about that structural reform?
I love it. That if you think about one of the reasons we're in the problem we're in right now is because of modern medicine and modern transportation. So when they first came up, really not a joke if you think about it, you know, the fact that it did not used to be a thing that you left the Supreme Court toes up. I mean, people used to actually resign, go on with their lives. And transportation is another thing, because you used to literally have to ride the circuit on a horse. So it was a young man's game. I mean, imagine, you know, I'm sorry, I won't use a name. Some of the older Supreme Court justices riding on the circuit. You quit, right? It was a young person's game. And there are ways in which we are going to have to adjust our democracy to deal with the changes that we've had in the society since the framers wrote the Constitution. Modern medicine, so people live a lot longer. That's not to say that older people aren't good at what they do, but it does mean that that a good behavior appointment is no longer 15 years. It now could be, you know, 70. And the world just changes. It's not just that it's modern transportation, so you can literally fly back and forth to your to California or wherever, so you don't have that sense in Washington of working together with people because you're basically in the air a lot of the time. But here's one that really bothers me, and that's steel frame construction, 1873. And you think, really? She's upset about that? Yeah, because... Well, I'm not upset about it. I think it's really cool. The Flatiron Building in New York is just spectacular. But when the framers wrote the Constitution, they had no concept that we were going to be able, because of steel frame construction and because of modern transportation, to crowd gazillions of people into very small spaces. So you have the problem now of the Senate, where somebody from North Dakota, for example, has equal representation to somebody from California. And that means, I think the number is 48 times the value of your vote in North Dakota than it is in California. And in fact, when we got the state of North Dakota, I don't mean to pick on North Dakota, but we got six new states between the in 12 months between 1889 and 1890. It was North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Washington. Even at the time, the reason they went in before 1890 was because the Republican Party wanted to make sure they kept the Senate forever. And they said this, I'm not making this up. I can tell you where the citations are. They're quite open about what they're doing, and they want to make sure they do it before the census of 1890 because they recognize that that's going to show that there ain't no people living in Idaho, right? And beautiful state, but what that has done is even at the time, opponents, even in the Republican Party, said, you are destroying democracy because you are making sure some people's voices are more powerful than other people's voices. And now look where we are with these giant cities, and the cities that vote overwhelmingly Democratic are being outvoted by the countryside. And that, again, was a deliberate choice on the part of Congress in 1929 when they capped the House of Representatives, and they did so because they recognized that the census of 1920 showed that more people were living in cities than there were living in the countryside, and they were immigrants. And you couldn't skew the vote toward newcomers, so instead they skewed the House of Representatives. Those things will all be things that we must deal with in the next generation, because right now, as I say, we're having a real problem with minority rule in this country. Yeah. See, you should all go study history.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that there's not much that Heather Cox Richardson and Liz Cheney agree on politically. But you've heard Heather say that we're standing on the knife's edge of democracy. And I think it was yesterday that Liz Cheney said, we have 9 months to save this democracy. And that just made me think that there are a lot of people that are also thinking, in fear or with their eyes open about the potential loss of democracy. And I'm wondering what ways there are to bring those people with whom, like Liz Cheney, we probably don't agree on much of anything, but we agree on this. And how do we bring them in to with the rest of us to achieve what we all want to achieve, which is the retention of democracy?
One of the reasons I emphasize the people like Lincoln as much as I do, and those old touchstone figures, Fannie Lou Hamer is another one. The reason I do that is because I think we do have a shared civic language. We don't use that civic language a lot, but we could. And Lincoln is a name that everybody knows. And everybody, not everybody, but most people think of really well. And one of the things that I try and do is go back to those touchstones of our civic story and say, let's forget about the present. Remembering that 80% of us want common gun safety legislation. So one of the points I like to make is these are not minority positions, what I try and do is I try and hit those moments in our civic story that we all share. And I suspect, yes, that if the Representative Cheney and I were in Congress together, we would vote in opposite ways. But I respect the hell out of her. You know, she has really, every time you hear one of these guys going, oh, they're going to be mean to me, I think that woman has five children and she stood up to all of you. And I'm, but that seems like a good question to throw to you.
I saw that coming, Heather. Yeah. It is so true. Look at what happened in Ohio on issue one. We are the majority. That couldn't have happened with Democrats alone. It happened with a lot of independents, the majority of them. It happened with tons of Republicans too. We've got to stop talking about these issues of democracy and freedom in partisan terms. They aren't partisan issues. They're American issues. This election is about Americans versus extremism. And we need to claim that. And you got to talk to everyone you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Earlier, you mentioned minority rule slave owners in the Senate. Can you talk about how the Electoral College contributes to that, if it does? January 6th, among other things, was directly related to the EC. I'm confident more people will vote for democracy in the next election, but will they do it in the right places?
That's a very, very real concern. So the Electoral College made sense to me in the early days for the simple reason that how would you know if you lived in Massachusetts who the good guy was in Georgia? So the idea was to set up a system where individuals could elect the guys in their states who knew people, you know, so they could all get together and they could talk about who might be a good chief executive. And the idea was that for the most part, they wouldn't agree. So they'd come up with two or three names, usually three was what they were hoping, and then it would go into the House of Representatives where you would truly have a group of people who understood how this, you know, who the good guys were, and they would in turn elect an executive, which made a lot of sense before we had modern communication. Because remember, in the 1700s and the 1800s, early 1800s, the way you got information was by word of mouth, by letters, and by newspapers, and those things are going to travel primarily by ships. So they're not going to move very quickly. And this just made a lot of sense. This is 2024. We don't need our letters to come by ship any longer. So the Electoral College, of course, has perverted our democracy in a number of times. You all know 1876, but also 1888. That's how we got Benjamin Harrison. And don't even start me on Benjamin Harrison. And then more recently, my least favorite president, and that's saying something, more recently, we have more people who win the popular vote and lose election than ever before. And now it seems pretty clearly a strategy. And let me just tell you, the thing that keeps me up at night is not the popular vote at all. I am extremely, extremely concerned in the 2024 election because Donald Trump is not trying to win this election. Have you noticed that? He is not trying to win this election. He's not expanding the people he's reaching out. He's not moderating his message. All I can figure is that he is deliberately pumping up a violent group of people to create enough confusion in swing states that the electoral votes from those states will not be considered clear enough to be counted, and they can throw the election into the House of Representatives. That's where each state gets a single vote. And so long as there are more Republican states, and there is the point, of course, for packing the state Republican parties with loyalists, so long as there are more Republican states than Democratic states, he would be elected legally. And in case you think I made that up, that was pretty much the plan that John Eastman articulated for 2020. So the Electoral College is not our friend, and I would like to see it go, but I will tell you this, there's a lot of people who say, oh, you're trying to destroy the past, and that's a terrible thing. And my answer to that would be the Electoral College was always intended to be representational, not winner-take-all. The addition of the winner-take-all system comes after the election of 1796, as you all know, I'm sure, when Thomas Jefferson, one of the reasons I hate Thomas Jefferson, by the way, when Thomas Jefferson When Thomas Jefferson recognizes that if he had won all of the votes in Virginia, which has a gazillion votes, when they write the Constitution, they're like, you get three, you get three, you get three. Virginia, you get 4,068. You know, a little bit less than that. But Virginia, basically, the reason our presidents all come from Virginia early on is because they have a gazillion electoral votes. He recognizes that if he got Virginia, all of the Virginia votes he'd have won. So he convinces the Virginia delegation in 1800 to go winner take all. And after he does that, everybody else recognizes that if their guy is going to win, they got to go winner take all as well. Now, what would happen if we went representational, I think, is illustrated by the fact Nikki Haley was in Maine last week. Maine and Nebraska are the two states that split their electoral votes, and people have to campaign there. So one of the things I keep saying is, okay, if you don't want to get rid of the Electoral College, which you should, and you should also fix the problem of the capping of the House of Representatives, because that screws up the Electoral College as well, let's just make it representational again. And then every state becomes part of the game, right? It changes everything. So yeah, I'm not a fan. I know people are trying to get around it through the Popular Vote Compact, which I believe Maine joined last week. I could be wrong about that. But that's not something that we should be carrying any further into the 21st century. We should have left it behind in the 19th.
Next question.
You made a comment about the next generation and the important work that they have in front of them. I look around this room and I think so many of us have grown up in a world where we were taught about democracy and the importance of democracy. I'd be interested in your comments about the younger generation today and how they're being educated about the government of this country. Is public education being eroded in a way that is concerning to you? Or is what they're witnessing a galvanizing force for them?
That's a great three questions, actually, because I think, I think there's three separate issues there. One of the things that concerns me a lot is that it is my first observation is public school teachers do not get paid enough. If I got to be the Empress of the Universe, I have a list. And one of the things on the list, not at the top of the list, but pretty close to the top, is I'm going to solve the problem of when people complain about public school teachers. But I'm going to start by doubling their pay. And then we can discuss things. Anyway, I'm a big fan of public school teachers. Your next point is the next generation has been told democracy is a great thing, and they are watching, they are literally hiding under their desks from active shooters. They are watching the world burn around them and people saying, let's use more oil. They're watching their rights erode. And one of the things that desperately concerns me is that it's very hard to tell them that this is a good system when it has never worked for them. And honestly, this is a discussion not for them, but for their elders. And I have had it with older people in positions of power saying to them, what do you think is going to happen? Like if you're told the system is great and you are literally being shot in second grade, why would you care about preserving it? And that is of real concern to me. And that's nothing to do with what they are literally being taught. It's the way that their lives are because of what we have allowed to happen to our democracy. But the next piece of that is the school system eroding. I think that is quite a deliberate action on the part of the radical right, is to destroy our public schools. And that is a way of destroying this country. Because the country is about a shared system of understanding of the way things work. Even things like Common Core were designed to enable people to move state to state without missing biology class, which is taught in sophomore year in some states and junior year in others. And apparently some people thought we should learn basic biology. Who knew? So that the school voucher movement right now has me absolutely terrified, but I also think there is a larger picture to that. Crucial to a democracy is an educated population. And that's one of the things Lincoln came back to again and again and again, is that there's a problem with democracy. You can't have democracy if you have a group of people who don't understand what their interests are. And we have quite deliberately created that, I think, since the 1980s. And that seems to me to be something on the absolute front lines, is protecting our public schools from the people who are trying to privatize them, both for profit and for theology.
Central to the fight for democracy.
The Suburban Women Problem was created by Red, Wine, and Blue. Our producer and editor is Amy Thorstenson, our project manager is Lindsay Quist, and our editorial assistant is Abigail Martin. For more information about upcoming events and trainings, or to learn more about Red, Wine, and Blue, follow us on social media or at www.redwine.blue.